From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in Washington today meeting with President Donald Trump. They took part in a roundtable about advancing female entrepreneurs. And in about an hour, they'll be taking questions from the media. Joining us now with more is NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi there, Ron.
Hi, good to be with you, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So let's first talk about what both President Trump and Prime Minister Trudeau may hope to get from today's meeting, because they really couldn't be more different, could they? I mean, Trudeau is, for example, taking pride in letting Syrian refugees into Canada. So what is he hoping to get out of his meeting with the president today?
The most important thing here is the primacy of the trade relationship between these two countries. It's really impossible to overstate how important it is, especially to Canada. Canada is our number one trading partner. A lot of people in the United States don't realize that. Everybody in Canada knows that. Three quarters of their exports go to the United States. Something like 2 million, 2.5 million Canadian jobs are linked to trade with the United States. So no matter what their differences on a host of issues, these two men are going to have to get along in one sense or another.
Yeah, I mean, just if we imagined for a moment, if we lived in the country who was sending three quarters or 75% of our exports to one other nation, we'd be paying very close attention to what that leader was saying. So, I mean, Ron, let me ask you, whenever the president speaks about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, it's commonly presumed, because the president basically says it, that he's being critical of American jobs that are shipped south to Mexico. Have we heard the president say specifically about his views in NAFTA and Canada?
The president has primarily been focused on our relationships southward in NAFTA, but there have been issues with our trade with Canada as well. And one of the big things the president likes about NAFTA is the prospect of greater trade in energy. He supports the pipelines that are sort of a side issue for Justin Trudeau. He's a good environmentalist, but he is for the pipelines. And so they do have some points of intersection there where they could probably do business. Now, of course, Justin Trudeau doesn't want to hear anybody say we're going to tear up NAFTA, but that kind of talk was probably always hyperbole, always some kind of an illustration or an image, and not the reality of what Donald Trump plans to do with NAFTA.
Interesting. We also should note that you mentioned the pipeline. Canada's energy sector is massive, and almost all, if not all, of Canada's oil gets sent to the United States there. So a lot of issues there regarding our northern neighbor. But Ron, while I've got you, let's turn for a moment, if we can, to where we are with White House National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Let's play a little bit of tape here. This is from Stephen Miller, the White House Senior Policy Advisor. He was asked about whether President Trump still has confidence in Flynn. This was on Meet the Press yesterday.
That's a question that I think you should ask the president, the question you should ask Reince, the chief of staff. I'm here today as a policy advisor, and my focus is on answering the policy questions that you have. General Flynn has served his country admirably. He is a three-star general, and I look forward to having more discussions about this in the future.
So the White House did not give you anything to say other
they
than
did not
that
give me,
on,
they did not
on General
give me
Flynn.
Anything to say.
On the other hand, an administration official was quoted today in the Washington Post, Ron, as saying, quote, Flynn is running out of friends. So what's going on here?
He does appear to be twisting slowly in the wind, as we used to say. The intelligence community was highly uncomfortable with Mike Flynn when he was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency under the Obama administration. It was partly his personality, some of the theories he had about national security, and mostly, or not mostly, but in addition to that, and perhaps most seriously, his relationships with some Russians. Now we have him in the administration, and after he apparently misinformed Mike Pence about his conversations with the Russian ambassador, Mike Pence went out and said that those conversations had nothing to do with U.S. sanctions on the Russians. Now we know that they did, and Mike Pence knows that they did. He is described as unhappy with that information. He's also made other people uncomfortable within the Trump cabinet. But it also appears that President Trump is not all that sad about having people be uncomfortable among his underlings, or for that matter, making people in the intelligence community uncomfortable. So it's conceivable that he could stand by his man, even though by standard Washington procedure, Flynn would have offered to step down by now.
Final question, Ron. Over the weekend, while Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was at Trump's resort, Mar-a-Lago in Florida, North Korea performed a ballistic missile test into the Sea of Japan. Both Abe and Trump later on gave some statements in response. Here's the president.
I just want everybody to understand and fully know that the United States of America stands behind Japan, its great ally, 100%. Thank you.
You got about 5 minutes to respond to that, Ron.
The president. Yes, I understand. Not an accidental piece of timing here. The Koreans wanted this to happen exactly at the moment when Abe and Trump were sitting down for dinner. This was the drama they wished.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Magda.
So as we heard, two leaders and neighbors meet today. Again, one difference between them. While President Trump indefinitely banned Syrian refugees, Prime Minister Trudeau went to the airport to greet them. Canada has resettled nearly 40,000 refugees from Syria alone in the last year. But what about the growing concern over refugees walking through waist-high snow in minus 20-degree weather to illegally cross the border from the U.S.? Now, this is largely because of the Canada-U.S. SAFE Third Country Agreement, a pact which says asylum seekers from a third country must apply for refugee status in the first safe country they arrive in, be it the U.S. or Canada. There are some exceptions, but a refugee entering an official port into Canada from the U.S. would be turned back. They'd have to apply in the U.S. first. But they can potentially get around that pact by crossing the border illegally and then applying, which many are doing because they don't feel the U.S. is safe. And that's a problem in the provinces of Quebec and Manitoba. In Manitoba, there's been a huge spike. Greg Jansen is Reeve, that's mayor of Emerson, Manitoba, about 700 residents on the Canadian border with North Dakota and Minnesota. Reeve Jansen, what have you seen with refugees crossing over?
Well, really, in the last week here, we've had 43 people come across, 19 in one shot here last two weekends ago, and this last weekend we had 21 come in one shot. So our numbers are growing every week, every weekend.
Wow.
So it's, I guess we're getting a little concerned for safety reasons, but I mean, we've got... I'm not sure how we can change this other than our laws, and for them to claim refugee status, they actually have to jump the border, which doesn't seem right.
Well, that's if they live. I want to talk more about the process, but that's if they live. We understand many of these are refugees from Somalia, Ghana, warm weather places, and it is bitter cold where you are. And there's a story I'm sure is captivating people there of a Ghanaian refugee who crossed. He's going to lose his fingers, toes, maybe his arms. And the only way he survived was flagging down a truck driver to pick him up.
They're literally risking their lives when they're coming out here. They're not dressed for our weather. This last weekend, I'll say it was really warm. We were 5 degrees Fahrenheit. That is warm. The weekend before, it was close to minus 10. And these people are coming across, light jackets, some of them with no gloves, no toques. They're risking their lives doing it.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
What is that like for when 19 people from another country show up in the middle of your small town?
Well, I had a phone call first thing Saturday morning, and that's how it all started. And it's fairly early. I get a phone call from a resident saying at 4 in the morning, my doorbell started ringing like crazy, and they're banging on the door. He woke up from dead sleep. He's got young kids, and he looks. He didn't recognize anybody. He called 911 right away, and he said in a dead sleep and barely awake, it startled him.
Yeah.
I guess the biggest concern that we have is, from my understanding and some of the personal feelings that are going around is, okay, they're in a safe country now. They landed into the United States. They've already applied for refugee status in the United States. And a lot of these people that are crossing the border illegally are either going to be deported or they've already been not accepted as a refugee in the United States. So how can you be not accepted in the U.S. and be accepted into Canada. And that's where that doesn't seem right, because U.S. is a safe country. If they're not eligible for refugee status in the States, so why should they be in Canada?
Yeah. Well, and of course, some would say that the new rhetoric in the U.S. and the travel bans that were just issued make it not a refuge for some people.
I think there has a lot to do with it. That's why we're seeing bigger groups. Before, like you had said earlier, there's 400 people since last March, but they were always coming in groups of 4 to 6 at a time and maybe 12 on a weekend in 2 different days. We're seeing a bigger concentration of groups coming at once now, just really a week after your president had put this ban on.
Yeah. That's Greg Janssen. He's Reeve, or mayor, of the town of Emerson in Manitoba on Canada's border with North Dakota and Minnesota. Reeve Janssen, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Yep. Thanks for calling.
80% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. They like his conservative Supreme Court nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch. But many expected him to roll back President Obama's executive orders protecting the LGBT community. He didn't. Will he be forgiven? Dr. Richard Land is a member of Trump's White House Faith Advisory Council. He says he believes in forgiveness. He lost his own radio shows after saying that President Obama used the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida to gin up the black vote. Land later apologized. So what report card does he give Donald Trump? Dr. Richard Land, president of the Southern Evangelical Seminary, welcome.
Thank you.
And you're quoted as saying after Trump won that God is welcome back to D.C. So how do you think President Trump is doing?
Pretty well. Not perfectly, of course, but better than most evangelicals and conservative Catholic Christians expected him to do. First of all, Judge Gorsuch, that was a huge factor, the understanding that the Supreme Court was in the balance and that if we lost the Scalia seat, that it would probably be a generation before we would have a working conservative majority of strict constructionist, original intent jurists. And in reality, Judge Gorsuch, he's almost like a clone of Scalia without the attitude.
Without Scalia's attitude.
Yeah. I mean, Scalia was pretty feisty.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Gorsuch is sort of a WASP version of Scalia.
Okay. Well, there's that. But as you well know, you weren't always supportive of Donald Trump. But back in August, you wrote a statement to other evangelicals who were opposed to electing Donald Trump, candidate at that time. And you wrote, "Let me be as transparent as possible. I know several of the Republican presidential primary candidates personally, and they were all far preferable to Mr. Trump. Out of the 17, he was my 18th choice." So are you saying that, I mean, some might say, wait a second, a Supreme Court nominee is worth it for all the other things you obviously did not like about a candidate Trump?
Well, that was in relation to the other Republican presidential candidates. But, and I think I can say this with perfect confidence, probably 3/4 of that 80% of white evangelicals who voted for Mr. Trump saw themselves more as voting against Mrs. Clinton than voting for Mr. Trump. Hmm. And so I knew that Mr. Trump was not going to do a lot of things we wanted him to do. First of all, he's not really a conservative.
That's what people will say in their criticism to you. They'll say, how can you support someone who's had several messy marriages and divorces, who talked about grabbing women's body parts in a crude and just violent way? How can you?
Well, as I said in that column that you quoted from, the 2016 presidential election, an excruciating choice. It was an excruciating choice. I still think that Mr. Trump was the lesser of two evils, and he is proving me right so far, putting back in place the Mexico City policy, which is not going to force taxpayers to pay for groups that promote abortion overseas and kill children in the second and third world.
And others would characterize it as a bill that is denying funds to aid groups that give much-needed health care, including abortions to women overseas. But I take your point. That's
for
you.
I don't think abortion is ever good unless it's a direct threat to the mother's physical life.
Well, these aid groups say they encountered that. But I take your point. That's a big victory for you.
It is a big victory.
Yeah, where else are you seeing victories?
Well, I mean, the cabinet is probably the most conservative cabinet since Calvin Coolidge. And I don't know any evangelicals who haven't been surprised at how consistently good it has been.
Well, so you're a big supporter of his cabinet nominees. And as you said, you feel God is welcome back in Washington. But, well, you know, not everyone feels that welcome. And not right. all evangelicals agree. What about the temporary ban on all refugees and the indefinite ban on Syrian refugees? Scores of evangelical leaders have taken out a full-page ad. As Christians, they write, we have an historic call over 2,000 years old to help the suffering. And I heard another evangelical say, you know, I'm pro-life, but that has to mean all life, including refugee life. So how do you score that?
Well, do these people lock the doors of their homes?
I have no idea.
My guess is they do so because your home is secure and you invite people into your home under the understanding that you think they're not going to do you harm. And when we have groups like ISIS who are saying they are going to use the refugee policy to infiltrate terrorists into the United States, we have a right to defend ourselves. And I would remind you that the seven nations that were specifically mentioned were seven nations that Mr. Obama said were particular breeding grounds for terror and should be dealt with differently. And Chuck Schumer voted for that bill in 2015. So let's leave the hypocrisy off for a while.
Well, I hear you. But do you worry about the message to your fellow faithful, to Muslims, especially since you in particular dropped out of a group that was supporting the right of Muslims to build mosques? Seems pretty simple. You said it's because while many Southern Baptists share your deep commitment to religious freedom and the right of Muslims to have places of worship, they also feel that a Southern Baptist denominational leader, meaning you, being part of a suit to allow individual mosques to be built is a bridge too far. Why not? Why not be the leader that stands up and says, of course we're going to support our fellow faithful?
Well, we support them in having the right to have mosques. What Southern Baptists made clear to me, and I did work at that time for Southern Baptists, was they did not want our resources being used to help them do it, that they should contend for that themselves. I didn't necessarily agree with that position. Look, Muslims have a right to have mosques. We believe in religious freedom in this country, but we don't believe that our religious freedom allows people to advocate for and to use violent means to seek to overthrow our government. That's called treason.
What does that have to do with mosques? I'm sorry. Building mosques.
Well, we have radical Islamic terrorism, which is dedicated to killing Americans.
Well, but they're talking
about
building
mosques.
That's
what ISIS is doing.
I know, but they're talking about building mosques. Wouldn't it be, wouldn't that be like saying, you know what, at a certain time in this country, we're going to shut down every Christian church in this country because the KKK is working out of those churches?
This is why NPR gets a bad rep among some people, you know? That's not what I was saying. They have the right to have mosques. They do not have the right to foment rebellion in those mosques any more than white supremacists would have the right in a Christian church to try to advocate for violence against people that disagree with them. I'd say the same thing about a synagogue. I would say the same thing about a Hindu temple.
Do you worry about a slippery slope that someday it could be your faith?
Well, of course. I'm a Baptist. You know, when I was a child, the Jehovah's Witnesses would show up and the Mormons would show up just at dinner time. And I asked my mother, I said, you know, why can't the government do something to stop them from doing that? She said, well, honey, if they can stop the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons today, they can stop the Baptists tomorrow. And I agree with that. I agree with that. Absolutely.
I want to go further into the checklist. Are you disappointed that President Trump did not roll back President Obama's executive order that gave protection to the LGBT community? The New York Times reports that there was a draft executive order, but Ivanka Trump and her husband Jared Kushner intervened, and the draft executive order would have turned back some of these protections against the LGBT community. But the statement that did come out said President Trump is determined to protect the rights of all Americans, including the LGBTQ community. He continues to be respectful and supportive of LGBTQ rights. Were you disappointed in that?
Not particularly, because I didn't expect him to do it. I'll be more disappointed if he doesn't come through with the executive order that protects people of faith from being discriminated against in the federal workforce if they have conscience issues with the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community. And if he comes out with that executive order, then that's a pretty good balance, actually. You have protections in the federal workforce for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people as well.
Don't they collide? Because if the...
No, not necessarily. You could have both coexist together without denying rights to either one.
So the gay couple that wants to get married and wants the wedding cake, and the baker doesn't want to make the cake on religious grounds, the gay couple goes to another place to get the cake.
Why force a Christian couple to bake the cake for a wedding ceremony? To try to use the government and weaponize the government to force them to violate their religious convictions seems to me to be mean-spirited and, frankly, un-American.
What about Donald Trump himself? He went to a famous New York church that's in the Reformed Church of America tradition. Full disclosure, that was my church tradition growing up. Very much influenced by Norman Vincent Peale, mm-hmm. the power of positive thinking. But Dr. Peale's son has spoken out against Donald Trump. He says, we don't like Trump associating himself with our father, especially since it suggests that his father emphasized material success, and that was not the main characteristic of his ministry. Big time. What do you think about Donald Trump, the faithful man?
Well, my experience with Mr. Trump, which has not been that vast and deep, I think I have met him twice and been on the phone when in a conference call a couple of times, is at deep variance with the Donald Trump that is revealed more than a decade ago on those Access Hollywood tapes. I think he's a different man now than he was then. And of course, as a Christian, I believe in redemption. And second chances, and third chances, and fourth chances.
Well, with that in mind, if there's a passage you'd recommend, do you want to share it, and why, to the president?
Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 16. You are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven.
Wow, the light of the world. Big responsibility.
To whom much is given, much is asked. Yeah. And very few people in world history have ever been given more than Americans have been given just by the providence of being born here.
Dr. Land, president of the Southern Evangelical Seminary, a member of President Trump's White House Faith Advisory Board, thanks so much for taking some time with us. Thank you.
You bet.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist, from politics to business and finance. From science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Fed Chair Janet Yellen will be testifying on Capitol Hill starting tomorrow. It's a semi-annual event, but this one is her first since President Donald Trump took office. And the president, as you'll remember, was very critical of Yellen during the campaign. He accused her of keeping interest rates low, quote, for political reasons, even though Yellen was continuing policies carried out by Republican appointees. So what can we expect from the Fed chair during this first part of the Trump administration? Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her new podcast is Better Off, and she joins us now. Hi there, Jill.
Hello.
So if you were Janet Yellen, or actually, maybe I was going to say, what would you say to Congress tomorrow? But maybe I shouldn't ask that. What do you expect her to say tomorrow?
I think she's going to give us a rundown of what's going on in the economy. And she's going to say, hey, the labor market is improving slowly. We are starting to see prices tick up a little bit. And the Fed has wanted to see that. I think that she also may start to talk a little bit about how things aren't perfect. And that's why the Fed continues to take its time in waiting to raise interest rates. And then she's going to have to field a whole bunch of questions. And, that you know, especially when she goes before the House subcommittee, this may not be the friendliest encounter.
Okay, so tell me more about that. Because of criticism of the Fed or Fed?
Well, a little bit of both. So you should all remember way back in 2015, there were certain Republican lawmakers that really have been seeking to limit the Federal Reserve's independence. Remember, the Fed is not an agency. It's independent, right? So Congress doesn't have a lot of control over it. They even passed legislation, only went through the House, it never got to the Senate, which would subject the Federal Reserve Board of Governors to an annual audit, which would say, hey, if you're going to make policy rate decisions, it has to be to a known standard, that anything that you have in a meeting, it has to have a transcript that's made public. And there's a little bit of kabuki theater about the Fed. They don't like that. They like their independence. And they've really pushed back against any intervention by Congress into what they do.
Okay. So there was a recent headline in the New York Times that President Trump and Janet Yellen are, quote, on a collision course. I mean, how much do they differ in terms of how they view the economy and how to grow the economy?
Well, you know, I think that when you heard candidate Trump talk about the economy, and even as he does now a little bit more, even though he sort of owns the economy at this point, he paints a very dark view. And you think back to, you know, the inauguration, it seems like a very, very dismal view of what was going on in the United States. And he did highlight problems that obviously there are certain persistent issues that exist. But, you know, when we look back to 2009, 10, 11, and we think, my God, that was when the economy was losing hundreds of thousands of jobs. And we must admit that, of course, we have made great progress. Now, Janet Yellen is all about the progress. And she said, hey, we're going to grow this economy. And it looks like we're at about a 2% growth rate. Remember what Donald Trump said. He said his policies are going to help the economy grow by 3.5 to 4%.
Right, right.
One of them's going to be right and one of them's going
to
be wrong.
So, I mean, okay, just I'm curious. You got a couple seconds here, Jill. To achieve that double growth rate, that 4%, what could the Fed do? What should the Fed do?
Well, I mean, what Trump says he's going to do is do a lot of spending. He's going to change the tax code and that will actually spur growth. By the way, the Fed doesn't believe that's going to happen. In fact, they are a little bit worried those policies might actually create inflation. That would force them to raise rates even faster. That might limit the Trump potential 3.5 to 4% growth. So collision course indeed.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thanks so much.
Take care.
In 2014, Tanisha Anderson was 37 years old and suffering from mental illness when she died in the custody of Cleveland police. According to the medical examiner's office, she was handcuffed and was lying on her stomach and officer's knee in her back when she stopped breathing. Her family recently settled a lawsuit against the city for $2.25 million. Her death was one of several that led to a 2015 agreement to reform Cleveland's police department, which the Justice Department said showed a pattern of using excessive force on people with mental illness. Well, now the police, with the Alcohol, Drug Addiction, and Mental Health Services Board of Cuyahoga County, are using new guidelines to help officers deal with suspects suffering from mental illness or addiction. William Denahan heads that board and has also served as Cleveland's acting chief of police. He joins us now. And William, Bill, you've called the new training an opportunity. You've said the police need to do a better job. What have you heard from the police? Do they wish they'd had a better way of handling things?
Well, we do know after we talk to them that there is a certain trauma that they face in going through these situations. And not having the training and how to sensitize an individual and familiarize them with the nuances of those that are mentally ill and or have addictions puts an officer in a difficult situation. When they get the training, it's a lot different. They understand the nuances that they have, and they have a familiarity to who they're working with. And instead of arresting, we're finding ways to find treatment. And instead of accelerating a situation, they're finding out how to de-escalate a situation on the scene so that they could bring some harmony with the community and the individual that is having an incident. You know, one of the things that we know across America, the largest mental health hospital is the prison system. And the idea that, you know, mental illness is a disease, as is addiction, and diseases can be treatable. People recover, and getting people into recovery is a lot better than locking them up for what appears to be very poor behavior.
This has been the thinking about drug addiction most recently after the Gloucester, Massachusetts police chief decided from then on out there would be no arrests of addicts who came in and turned in their works. Instead, the police would find a bed for them in a hospital, a treatment hospital, and also hook them up with a volunteer who could work with them. But I'm thinking, you're talking about police that are going out on the street and maybe, you know, encountering somebody in real crisis. How else are you training the police to deal with somebody that may be acting violently, acting out, their family knows they might be having a psychotic break, for instance, but your police might not know that?
We have a special team of two police officers and two social workers that's working on a pilot program in one of our districts on the second shift. These are the cases where the police officers say to the dispatcher, somebody else, say, we've been there. We were there last week. That is a continuous showing of behavior. So getting to the bottom of that behavior takes individuals that have social work experience, and putting with a police officer, we're able to bring the person into treatment. and resolve the situation. Persons are not on their medication, for example. So getting them to their caseworker and their provider and finding out why they're not on their medication. Did they lose it or did they not have enough money for it? There's a whole number of reasons.
Well, in Tanisha Anderson's case, and it sounds just horrific, she suffered schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. Her family said she was having a breakdown. She was out on the street in her nightgown. The police came, handcuffed her, hands behind her back, put her in the car when she got out, putting the knee to her back. She was on her stomach and thought that she had asphyxiated. That move alone, putting people on their stomach, I understand that that will be forbidden.
Well, police officers are trained to protect themselves, and they protect themselves in many, many ways. That is not to justify anything in the Anderson case. We've got to learn from situations like that on how to better represent the community and protect the community. And one of the things that the Cleveland police officers, all officers, will go through an 8-hour training session so that they're all sensitized to those with mental illness and addiction. Then there are special officers who are in the squad cars will go into 40 hours of crisis intervention training, which also protects them. We find out that the number of injuries for officers goes down when we do this training. So there is a positive byproduct of finding respect and dignity that the citizens need, but also protecting the officers.
That's William Denehan, head of the Drug Addiction and Mental Health Services Board in Cleveland. They are about to implement a new policy when it comes to police interaction with the mentally ill or substance abuse users. Those in crisis are to be taken to the hospital rather than arrested. Bill, thanks for talking to us about it.
Well, thank you for this opportunity.
We want to take a moment now to remember retired Army Lieutenant General Harold Moore. Moore died Friday at his home in Auburn, Alabama. He'll be buried at Fort Benning in Georgia this Friday. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports on his life.
Hal Moore is best known for his leadership in the first major battle between U.S. and North Vietnamese forces during the Vietnam War, the Battle of Ya Drang. Reporter Joe Galloway was there. In 2015, he spoke to Here and Now about convincing Lieutenant Colonel Moore to allow him to go into the battle with his troops. It was sort of a last-minute embed.
I had marched with Colonel Moore's battalion 3 days before and spent the night with him up in the mountains. And I recognized his operations officer, Captain Dillon, and I grabbed him. And I said, "Matt, I need to get into this fight." And he said, "Well, I'm going in with two helicopters full of ammunition as soon as it's dark. But I can't take you without the colonel says so." And I said, "Get him on the radio." And he reported to the colonel. And then he said, "Sir, that reporter Galloway is here, and he wants to come in with me." And I was listening very close for the answer, and Colonel Moore said, "If he's crazy enough to want to come in here and you got room, bring him." So I had my ride into the pages of history.
It was November 1965, and the bloody fighting dragged on for several days. The Battle of Ya Drang claimed the lives of more than 200 Americans and hundreds of North Vietnamese soldiers. Again, Joe Galloway.
On that day, Colonel Moore's battalion, the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, numbered about 400 men. And they were dropped in by helicopter far from the nearest road and almost immediately were surrounded by an enemy force numbering perhaps 2,000. I was not a greenhorn. I had been 7 months in Vietnam covering the U.S. Marines in the northern part of the country. And I had been shot at, but I had not seen anything the equal of the hand-to-hand combat that ensued over the 3 days of this battle. And I must tell you, I went to war for 43 years after that battle and never again saw anything to match it.
In this newsreel after the battle, Lieutenant Colonel Moore reflected on the intensity of the fight. when he talked about his men.
Having commanded this battalion for 18 months, you must excuse my emotion here, but when I see some of these men go out the way they have, I can't tell you how highly I feel. They're tremendous.
Moore and Galloway later wrote the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young. The book was turned into a movie with Mel Gibson starring as Colonel Moore.
Dead or alive, we will all come home together. So help me God.
Moore and Galloway collaborated on a second book called We Are Soldiers Still. That book documented their return to the battlefields of Vietnam 25 years later. When he got the news that Hal Moore had died, Joe Galloway told the Associated Press, "He was a great human being, my best friend, and one of the finest commanders I've ever seen in action." Hal Moore would have turned 95 today. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Fur High School in Northeast Houston once had the kind of reputation no school wants. It was plagued by gangs and had a high dropout rate. Now school administrators are trying to turn things around with some innovative programs that are drawing national attention. Laura Eisensee from Here and Now contributor Houston Public Media takes us on campus for something called Genius Time.
When the last period of the day starts at Fur High School in Houston, students switch from their regular classes to genius time. That's when students get to choose what they want to learn, and that can be almost anything. Like Zumba. Inside the auditorium, dozens of teenagers crowd the stage. They sidestep, clap, and spin to the beat for an intense workout. Janie Leo dances in the front. The 18-year-old senior sports black tights and a Mickey Mouse t-shirt. Her favorite songs are the Latin cumbias, like the ones her parents play. She picked Zumba for Genius Time for another reason, though. She cares about health.
There's a lot of chronic diseases going on, mostly with minorities. I'm a Latina, and I know because of my grandma. She has diabetes, and I'm scared that that'll happen to me, too, because I know she takes a lot of medicine, and I don't want that for my future or my brother and sister.
Leos cares so much that she's learned how to teach Zumba out in her community. That's the kind of passion that faculty at Fur want to encourage with Genius Time.
It gives them that ability to start having choice and voice. And you can see it from the kids as they're progressing.
That's Fredelina Pieri. She's an administrator at Fur.
Because at first, they would go with their friends and their little cliques kind of thing. And as time goes on and you see the offerings, the kids actually start focusing on their interests and their passions that they have.
Pieri says Genius Time is one way to transform high school. It's an ambitious goal that Fur set when it won a $10 million grant from a nonprofit run by Laureen Powell Jobs, Steve Jobs' widow. The idea is to engage kids' passions. So for Genius Time, there are a lot of options. Russian cooking, 3D printing, martial arts, and...
How to Train a Puppy is one of those things that people are like, how to train a puppy?
Sophomore Rosa Rubio summons a pit bull named Chico. She and 10 other students practice call and response with the dogs.
Oh, you're so cute.
Rosa says the puppies have taught her discipline and stress management, and she credits Genius Time for keeping other kids in class who used to skip.
And then it's actually a good thing because it can be happy with the school and like go to class, get excited for the next day to come and do what they want.
But is letting kids do what they want a good way to help them learn? Benjamin Riley is with the nonprofit Deans for Impact.
We should not be so enthusiastic about personalized learning along the reasons I described.
Riley says one of those reasons is science about how the mind works, that what a child learns builds on what they already know.
We know that students in general, or anybody who doesn't have a very good understanding of a particular topic or subject, is not in the best position to figure out how to learn those things. And that's, again, why we have the profession called teaching and why we have professionals called teachers.
Riley urges schools to focus on how those teachers, not puppies, can best teach children. But here's another take on personalized learning. Rebecca Wolf is with the national nonprofit Jobs for the Future.
I think that it's easy to look at individual offerings and say, good God, what are students doing in Zumba class or training puppies when we need engineers of the future and how are they ever going to learn to read?
But Wolf says research on how to best motivate kids supports programs like Genius Time.
What excites them? What makes them feel healthy? What makes them feel part of a community?
Wolf says Genius Time should just be the start, and that's exactly what school leaders at FIR say they're trying to do. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
Well, another way to engage kids, music. At last night's Grammy Awards, Chicago hip-hop star Chance the Rapper took home the very first of the night Best New Artist. But it was Adele's night. She sang a tribute to George Michael and took home 5 awards, including Song of the Year for Hello and Album of the Year for 25, to which she said,
"But I can't possibly accept this award, and I'm very humbled and I'm very grateful and gracious, but my artist of my life is Beyoncé, and this album for me, the Lemonade album, was just so monumental, Beyoncé, it was so monumental."
Adele broke her award in half, later reportedly gave half to Beyoncé, both women setting a high bar for female competitors hitting grace notes. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.